Hello and welcome back to a big day here at the Damage Report. It's a big day. It's also a Wednesday. Thus, it's a JR Wednesday.
Is it that big of a day?
It's a big news day, I think.
It's a pretty big news day, I suppose.
I did a live video, which if you don't already know, on our YouTube channel, youtube.com/thedamagereport, I do live videos about a half an hour before this show goes live every morning that you can take part in. Mm-hmm. We covered some of the new polling, the ABC News, Washington Post poll of Bernie Sanders. He's up 15 points nationally over the number two. And he's leading in electability.
The thing
as well.
Is what the Democrats need is someone that can beat Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. Not someone that's up by 15 points in the primary amongst
that's
every other
true.
Candidate. We need one of those other candidates that can beat Donald Trump, because the one who's beating them, apparently.
He's got baggage, like his, you know, his wins in Iowa, New Hampshire. This baggage at this point. They need to shed some of that. But anyway, that's big.
And it's such a nuisance. It's such a nuisance. He'll come to states and he'll campaign. Mm-hmm. It's a nuisance.
It's when bothering
you
get, people.
Yeah, it bothers people when you cross traffic.
Exactly. That is,
that'll make
God,
them, that'll make
like
them
that.
Not vote for you.
Yeah. Look, we also have a debate, which we're both going to be doing coverage of. Yeah. Immediately following the debate, come back to the Young Turks. We're going to be giving our impressions. I expect it's going to be a big one. Maybe we'll talk about that throughout today. But we do have two candidates who are going to be joining us. So that's going to be very exciting. We also have Amy Klobuchar attempting to patch things over after her AMLO gaffe of not too long ago. And Rush Limbaugh. Had a conversation with Donald Trump. We're going to talk about that to close out the hour. But before we get to all of that, let's talk about some of the big news of the past 24 hours. Michael Bloomberg apparently was on video referring to the transgender community in incredibly transphobic terms. Now, I know you might be thinking, wait, this isn't news. This is like 3 weeks ago, right? You're probably talking about this headline, Bloomberg draws criticism for 2016 remarks about trans rights in Midwest. No, that's not what I'm talking about. Yes, he did say horrible things back in 2016, but that was all the way back in 2016. No, I'm talking about last year, when he had already been planning for 1 to 2 years to run for president. He was still throwing around transphobic language. Now, I would love to throw to the video of it. In fact, when I saw this news yesterday, I left a tab open on my computer where it was embedded. Now, when you go to that, you see this. Oh no, it's been pulled off the internet. It's been scrubbed. Weird how that, it had been up for almost a year at this point. It was March of last year. And then just yesterday, when people started to share it, suddenly they weren't interested in promoting the event anymore.
This is the mistake that you made.
That's weird.
John, whenever I see something like this, I part of what I have to do is find things where people have said in the past, and I'm pretty good at it.
Mm-hmm. That's one of your talents.
Pretty damn good at it, I'm just saying. but so I've seen these situations where I see something come out or something gets shared that's from years ago or even days ago. And I see it and I was like, this is gonna get taken down. It's gonna get scrubbed everywhere. So you captured immediately.
Yeah.
Do not wait, because it'll come back to find a black screen saying this video is unavailable.
Exactly. And look, I'm sure someone has it. If you have a link to it, feel free to tweet at the Damage Report on Twitter. We'd love to have that. Thankfully, all the different sites, including BuzzFeed, which is the one we just showed you, they do have what he said. So we can go to that. They have apparently used their massive financial prowess to pressure the organization to take it down. But anyway, so this is last year, March of 2019. He said, if your conversation during a presidential election is about some guy wearing a dress, and whether he, she, or it can go to the locker room with their daughter, that's not a winning formula for most people. They care about healthcare, they care about education, they care about safety, and all of those kinds of things. And so look, it is very similar to what he said in 2016, probably because this is what he actually believes and has believed throughout his life. And maybe he hasn't said it in the past 11 months, but it wasn't that long ago when he was being very open about it.
The best defense you have for this, which we'll see where the defense has come from, is, well, you know what? He's not talking about his personal feelings. He's talking about maybe an election situation where people don't want to appeal to certain ways. Because you know what? I remember, I don't know if I mentioned this to you real fast. After the last primary in New Hampshire, and then Buttigieg was up, and as he invited his husband up, I said, I wonder if they have an internal conversation about whether or not he should embrace his husband, give a hug or kiss or whatever, because they're worried about optics. Because although obviously everyone surrounding Buttigieg's campaign is okay with who he is, they probably worry about appealing, because he keeps talking about he wants those former Republicans. Those former Republicans have a really good chance of hating the fact that you're a gay man who's married, right? Mm-hmm. So I always wonder where politics start to try and figure out, hey, we're okay with this, but we know so many people aren't. Bloomberg isn't even doing that here. You would think, that's what I'm saying, the defense may be, he's just thinking politically. There's some people who are against normal things like a gay person, and then we want to make sure we still have them. Mm-hmm. But he says a guy, some guy wearing a dress, he, she, or it, all those things are personal.
Yeah, just say they.
There's a very
and
personal.
They. That way you're covering literally everyone.
That's how you
Why
feel.
Would you go out of your way to say he, she, or it unless you actually believe it? And unless you're so, you know, you feel this sense of entitlement and arrogance based around the fact that you're incredibly wealthy that, hey, I'm just, you know, I'm just hanging out with people that agree with me. I can say whatever I want.
Yeah,
I can,
I'm sorry.
I can refer to them as a person wearing a dress. How about say, if the conversation is going to be about trans rights, I worry that that will turn some people off. I would still disagree with you. Uh-huh. But at least then you wouldn't be denigrating the community that supposedly you're gonna then come back and say, no, I'm actually saying how much I care about them.
Yeah, and, you know, and also there's a breakdown as far as this, what he says, what people care about. Healthcare, education, and care about safety and all those kinds of things. That was the second half of the quote. This is where the cluelessness comes from, your hatred for very significant portion of Americans. These people that are disenfranchised, they care about healthcare. Healthcare for gay folks, a lot of times, is subverted or taken aside or not even given because of who they are. Education for these folks is always taken aside, or sometimes maybe there's a kid in school who gets bullied.
Discrimination
schools, yeah. They get break. There's no protections for these folks. And lastly, you're talking about safety. Let's talk about the fact that how many trans people have been killed, murdered, stalked out. Yeah. Lately, throughout our history, but we're hearing about more lately. So if you want people to care about safety, education, and healthcare, that's directly related to these people that you're calling it's and all this stuff that you don't care about. So you can connect all these things, but he has that blind spot because he hates them.
Yeah, we have all the data we need to know that if there's a hypothetical scenario, there's a bathroom, there's a trans woman, a cis man, and a kid in there. No one is in more danger there than the trans woman. Historically, that's just. I know that the straight white men are super scared of something happening. Like, no, you're gonna be just fine. Historically, it's the trans individual who's in the most danger there. And so, look, he goes on to say, and some of these social issues that, and it's not just the American government, the EU government does as well. We're focusing on a lot of things that have very little relevance to people who are trying to live in a world that is changing because of technology and communications and things like that. And look, I am so done with people taking a whole range of issues and then saying, God, why are you focusing on this stuff? Focus on issues that matter. And it's not just right-wingers like Mike Bloomberg. You can find people across the spectrum that are like, why are you talking about this stuff? It's a waste of time. Let's talk about something else. And always it's just the things that matter are the things that matter to me. Because I'm not, and by the way, when I say me, I mean literally people that look exactly like me and have a very similar life experience as me. Because if I'm not discriminated against for my gender, my race, ableness, and all of everything, well then I don't think about that stuff. Talk about stuff that does affect me, whatever, healthcare, economy, that sort of stuff. But for a lot of these people, yes, they're concerned about those things, but these are not like side concerns, their safety, their access to healthcare, those sorts of things, housing, being able to get a job. These are not small concerns and they're not just social issues. They are fundamentally economic issues. And so don't accept this sort of argument from literally anyone. If it's a clear, obvious right winger like Mike Bloomberg or whoever else, don't let anyone shame you from caring about the issues that have an impact on your life.
Yep. And the natural response, if you say, hey, let's talk about things that people care about, you're naturally saying, you don't matter. We don't care about you and your issues because these are people that you're talking about.
Yeah, it's very little relevance. Yeah, to people like Mike Bloomberg, I'm sure it is. Okay, let's turn to another related issue. So around this time, in a primary, an election, you're gonna start to get financial disclosures from all the candidates. What is their financing like, all of that stuff. Remember back in 2016, we had this big ongoing conversation about Donald Trump and how he would eventually, once he was not being audited, he'd give us his information and then that never happened. What if we had another person who was trying to pull the same thing? Hold on to your butts, maybe we do. Presidential candidates are required to reveal their investments, businesses, and streams of income. Now, Michael Bloomberg, the former New York City mayor, is the only Democrat currently running in this primary who has yet to file paperwork to publicly disclose this. Now, this does not mean that he's not eventually going to reveal it, but it might not matter by the time he does. Under an extension granted to him Friday by the FEC, the second one he's received, he can postpone this release until March 20th, which is not just a long way off, It's weeks after Super Tuesday. Yep. So he gets to get through a significant portion of, like, we've already gone through four states. We're to go through a significant chunk of all the delegates that are on offer. And maybe afterward, maybe he'll reveal this stuff. Remember when that bothered you about Trump, people?
Exactly. I said, if you don't see the parallels here, then you're just trying. You're not trying to. It's obvious. It's in your face. So if you had an issue with that before, and we're seeing this now, like, you're going to show your hypocrisy if you don't say, hey, we're going to see what happens. Because now this is the same reasoning. We're going to see where his real, his intentions lie and what he really wants to do. Because we know this type of person is not going to go out there and just be willy-nilly about things that they're looking to protect about themselves. There's reasons that everyone wants for office.
Yeah.
And the reasons behind it we may see if he actually releases these. Yeah. And we know, like, we had speculation about Trump. It's the same thing. People with money trying to find a way to make sure they hoard it or have it in a certain way, or don't want you to see what they've done with it in the past.
Yeah. By the way, I don't think I've ever seen italics in one of these lower thirds before right there. That's interesting. So look, now it's not that he's hiding anything he wants you to know. His attorney put out a statement saying, it's just complex, you know? That's what Trump said, by the way. It's just really complex. And then Bloomberg spokeswoman Galia Slayen declined to comment. That has been the Bloomberg campaign. They've got some ice cream ads, they've got a dog snout, and then they declined to comment to voters, to the press, to the other candidates. They don't have to say anything because they believe that if they just throw enough ads at you, you're gonna ignore all of this. You're gonna forget all the stuff that frustrated you about Donald Trump that is duplicated in Mike Bloomberg's behavior and history, and he'll just cruise through. And until then, decline to comment.
You wanna tout about how much money you have and why that's beneficial for your candidacy, but you don't wanna talk about how much money you have and how that can be detrimental to what you do for the rest of the people. You can't take the positive part and then just throw away the rest. Actually, you can. That's the way you've always done
apparently
it.
Apparently you can. Apparently you can. If you got the money, you can. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, lots more to get to.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Un-F-ing the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now is congressional candidate for New York's 12th district, Peter Harrison. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hey John, how's it going?
It's going good so far. Thank you again. We really appreciate you joining us.
Yeah, it was a pleasure.
There's a part of your platform, the Freedom of Movement in America plan that I want to focus on. But before we get to that, because I really do find this to be very interesting, tell us a little bit about yourself, how you came to launch this campaign.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, John, you know this because I've been on the show a couple times as a longtime housing activist, but that's primarily been the lens that I've done my activism, whether it's New York City or the national level. I think the affordable housing crisis is one of the most pressing problems in this country, and we need federal leadership to tackle that. But in the larger sense, I think really the 21st century has to be defined by embracing cities and making urbanism work if we're really going to solve economic inequality, racial injustice, and climate disaster. We really have to make cities work. So that's really been the center of my campaign. Housing is a big component of it, but obviously transportation is as well.
You know, actually, let's talk a little bit more about housing, though, because I am curious. I've just recently started to sort of think about the possibility of maybe eventually buying a house. And then I realized I'm in LA, so that's never going to happen. But I'm curious. So in the decade or so since the collapse, the last time, I know that there's a lot of fear. A lot of people like in a position like me that are very worried about the possibility that it could happen again. In terms of the way that the government, federally, state and local, approach housing issues, do you feel like there's been much evolution, much learning in the decades since that collapse?
Short answer, no. I mean, I think you just remember that, the Great Recession was really caused by this sort of speculative bubble in the housing market, the foreclosure crisis. Millions of Americans lost their homes. That never really ended. I mean, that's kind of the thing that gets lost sometimes 10 years out, where there has been the narrative of slow but steady economic growth. Is you never really solved the foreclosure crisis at the heart of the Great Recession, particularly for homeowners of color. Most of their wealth was wiped out. A number of those communities never responded or recovered. So I think just to start out, you know, we've never solved that problem. And instead of really tackling the core issues of why this crisis happened and some of the speculation within the housing market, unfortunately, the political establishment and the Obama administration bailed out the banks. So, you know, the idea of this happening again, it might not look the same as it did in 2007, 2008, but the same fundamental error of fetishizing homeownership and subsidizing it is still there. The federal government has not deeply solved that problem. I don't want to, you know, scare folks like you or others that might be buying a home somewhere, outside of the fact that if we live in cities, we can't afford them to begin with. But you know, it's not ever the case where that exact same problem is going to happen again. Yeah. But the structural stuff is there, and the Homes Guarantee, which I'm proud to have worked on, is really the first time that a national plan has been put together to actually address what caused that crisis.
So let's turn now to transportation. So you've got a new area of your platform around that. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, we're really excited to be the first federal campaign to introduce a plan to make all public transportation 100% free, accessible, and green. You know, me as a housing activist and as a lefty urbanist, prioritizing cities at the federal level is really the core of our campaign. And you really can't have deep affordability or economic mobility without making cities work. And transportation, I think, is really a core element of that. In New York City, the fares have continued to go up as the actual service in the MTA, which is the buses and the subways, has gone down. Traffic has gotten worse because of ride sharing and you know, third-party delivery services for Amazon Prime. So we're going in the opposite direction, both from a sense of the climate disaster that we are on the precipice of is really caused by our emissions. I think it's around 30% of our global carbon emissions comes from the transportation system. So there's just no meaningful solution to climate disaster without fundamentally reorienting our transportation policy towards cities, towards mass transit, towards walking and bikes. So the freedom of movement in America really addresses that in a very honest and comprehensive way. And it's exciting because there are these conversations happening at local levels. Kansas City, Michelle Wu up in Boston's talking about this. So this is part of a larger conversation that is happening at the local level. But I do think the federal government has a massive responsibility and access to massive resources to make this plan happen.
So I'm glad the link that you made between reforming transportation and obviously the benefits in terms of confronting the climate crisis. Let's talk about economics, though. Transitioning, let's say for New York, for instance, going completely fare-free, how do you get to that point?
Yeah, I mean, the interesting thing that's part of the conversation in New York City, which of course arguably has the best public transportation system in the country, although I think a lot of New Yorkers would scoff at that, or at least how good it is. But interestingly enough, you know, the fares have gone up. It's $2.75 now, and it used to be a nickel. My grandfather was a motorman on the New York City subways through much of the early part of the 20th century, and it was 5 cents. And they subsidized it on purpose because the city recognized that this was an opportunity for economic mobility, social mobility, getting people off the streets and into mass transit was a massive economic boom. We kind of lost sight of that during the austerity era that we've been living in. But still, interestingly enough, you know, the fares that we do get, that $275, it still only covers about 38% of the existing operating costs for the MTA. So even though that's a big chunk of money, that's a few billion dollars, it's still fairly manageable when you put the cost of not doing that into perspective. So the idea of just removing the fares at the buses or the subways, the cost infrastructure of managing that process, the social and racial injustice of putting millions of dollars into putting subway cops instead of actual better subway service. So, I mean, from an economic standpoint, I don't dodge that question. It's actually a boon to the economics of New York City to allow this system to have more coverage and to be free. The money that we're spending already on this system pales in comparison to the costs from traffic, the cost of bad transportation systems, and obviously climate cost of it.
I mean, it's just a fascinating plan. If people want to find out more about it, where can they go?
Yeah, the website is www.peterfornewyork.com. I have a section specifically on the Freedom of Movement plan. We've been getting a lot of great press, a little bit nationally, certainly locally. There are some great state level candidates, some DSA members that I'm friends with are also promoting it at the state level. So there's a lot of traction for this conversation. So yeah, check out the website and please check out the plan and share it. I mean, this is something that can work obviously in a big city like New York, but should also be part of the conversation in smaller cities in this country.
Peter Harrison, thank you for joining us once again.
Appreciate it.
We'll take a short break here. When we come back, in Nevada, the last stretch of campaigning is going on. We're gonna touch base with a couple of candidacies there after this. In a recent series of Telemundo interviews, Amy Klobuchar, as well as Tom Steyer, had issues remembering who the president of Mexico was. And I've been wondering, what is the explanation going to be for that apparently difficult to understand gaffe? Well, Klobuchar was asked about it at a CNN town hall this week. Here's what she had to say.
You were asked to give the name of the president of Mexico. Mm-hmm. You couldn't at the time. Mayor Buttigieg did know the name, and he says it helps his argument that Washington experience isn't necessary to be president. Does it?
Oh, my. Okay, well, first of all, I would like to give my greetings to President Andre Manuel Lopez Obrador, the president of Mexico. When that happened, for what it's worth, I had been in the Senate all day. We had 6 votes, and including a resolution to be a check on the president so he doesn't go pell-mell into war with Iran. And I got on a plane and got there, I think, at midnight my time and had a fast interview and then did 2 forums after that, I think ending at about 2 or 3 in the morning. So, you know, such is life. And I would say to the mayor, this isn't like a game of Jeopardy. This is about, to me, experience, and I have so much respect for him and his experience, but my experience is different.
Okay, so we're gonna talk about the Jeopardy comment, but before that, what do we think about her explanation? That she was very, that they had done a bunch of Senate stuff, and then they flew in, and there were a bunch of hearings, and that's why she couldn't remember who he was or anything
well,
about
Well, I mean, okay. That's an excuse.
Do we buy it?
There's a difference between an excuse and a reason. No, because you would have said that then. If I knew the name of a president, I'd get the name slip your mind. I forget people's names all the time. I forget people's names that I've known for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, and I'd do it and people go, how did you forget his name? I was like, I don't know, man. I just forgot his name. I'm having a brain fart. So that happens. But you at least know, because I'll describe the person, because I know who I'm talking about, because I know them. I know Jim. I just forgot Jim right now.
Yeah.
When you're tired and you've been working so long and you have to answer the question, you say, instead of saying, oh, I'm blanking on his name right now, but he does this and that. It was, I don't know.
Yeah.
No, I don't know. Because he asked her a couple times, wait, so you don't know it? No, I don't know it. It's the difference between knowing it and forgetting
it. And remembering it. Yeah. Yeah, and yes, if you're tired, you will let some things slip. But I mean, you're a senator and you'd been dealing with the USMCA like the past like couple months. Like it's that's not the sort of thing that should drop off. Like I don't know, like if I like worked out really hard, I don't forget who Emmanuel Macron is. Like it's not like, oh, I stayed up till 2, like true what's going on in Canada? I don't think that maybe I'm biased. Look, and obviously I've endorsed a different candidate. I am biased. I don't buy that explanation. I think that, look, just say, you know, he's a relatively new president in comparison to some of these other world leaders, maybe. But in all likelihood, it seems less important to her and probably to a bunch of politicians who, yeah, they're critical of how Trump deals with Mexico and how he talks about people from, you know, that part of the world. But does that mean that they take it very seriously? Probably not.
Probably not. But that's the other thing, and part about it is you have to understand the real answer to give wouldn't sound good. Because if you really didn't know, you'd have to say, you know what? I've actually dropped the ball and I actually haven't been up to date on what's going on with Mexican politics and the president at this moment. So actually, I should catch up on that. If you say that, it's like an insurance thing. When you get in a car accident, your insurance card says, never admit fault. Just don't admit fault. Just don't do it. No matter if you rear-ended the guy from looking at your cell phone, don't admit fault.
Yeah.
So that's the whole idea is you can't say, I dropped the ball there, because that's going to turn to a campaign ad for someone else. But in reality, that's the truth. Yes. And maybe it'll ingratiate you with enough people that'll go, yeah, I mean, you know, she dropped the ball in his name, but she's committed to wanting to make sure that she knows this.
Yeah, and so finally the comment about to Buttigieg from her, that this isn't Jeopardy. Like, Senator Klobuchar, I don't much like Buttigieg either. I'm totally with you there. But like we've spent years mocking and being frustrated with Donald Trump because of his lack of interest and curiosity about world affairs.
It was with Palin too.
It's not, and Palin too, like the anti-intellectualism. And obviously I'm not saying that Klobuchar is anything like that, but describing like, you know, being interested in world leaders that butt up against our country as like Jeopardy, like it's a trivia thing. No, like being able to name 10 members of the legislature of Cameroon, maybe that's Jeopardy at some point. But knowing like the neighboring world leaders is not Jeopardy, it's not trivia. And it is your job, you are a senator, you deal with world affairs. And it's not just about Klobuchar, honestly I really don't care about Klobuchar at all. But it's about a lack of seriousness of people who use seriousness and experience as their like, that's why they should be elected.
Yeah, the Jeopardy line is her version of a gotcha question. You know, like when Palin said, hey, you can ask which newspapers I read. It's another word to call it a gotcha question. And without saying gotcha, because we know that's attributed to Republicans.
I will say that it is sadder to not be able to name a magazine you read than a world leader.
That's true.
They're both bad.
That's true.
But yes. You should be able to name like guns and ammo. Come on, you're a conservative.
And I think she mentioned, as you're flying to have this interview, you know you're going to speak with Telemundo. Read up a little bit. I get it. Be like, oh, maybe I should have his name ready.
Yeah.
But maybe didn't think that far ahead. I get it.
Okay, let's turn to a related issue. Okay, we are now turning in this Democratic primary race to non-100% white states like Iowa and New Hampshire. And some of the candidates have had an issue with sort of broadening their appeal outside of people who look just like them. So I'm not saying that's why some of these quotes I'm gonna show you have been made, but it's not a big leap to imagine that that might be. So I want you to take a look at Pete Buttigieg at an event in the past week.
So much for the chance to join you. Gracias por invitarnos para hablar this evening. And I bring greetings from South Bend.
Yeah, you should bring those greetings back to South Bend, okay? And then study up on the Spanish. It sounded okay in the beginning, but when you fall apart like that and then like you can't like go in a different direction in the same language, you just sort of stop. It sounds to me, and we've talked about this, as if that was a specific thing that you had memorized. And look, I am not great with languages. I've taken a few languages. I spoke some French, I spoke some Arabic. I don't remember much of it. I also don't go around talking about myself as a like polyglot or whatever.
Greetings from Surbend. Kind of craziness.
Yeah. So that it's probably just, is not gonna help.
But even when it's done and they're trying to polish it, it looks rehearsed. We can tell like the authenticity of it just isn't there. If it's not authentic, don't even try it, because authenticity is a thing. You can't fake authenticity, because people who are really in that position know, they can feel it. I used to speak Spanish fluently. I forgot significant amounts of it. I passed as a Spanish speaker with native Spanish speakers. I was down in San Diego and I was talking to them, and these like 13-year-old kids, I was working with my pops, and I was just going back and forth with them, and they stopped and they were like, he said, "You Puerto Rican?" And I was like, "No." So like they couldn't figure out what my background was because I was speaking it that well. That's authenticity for doing it, because I was immersed in the culture enough that I was thinking in Spanish. If that's happening, use it there. But if you're trying to recite some lines, people who know it will see it and they'll call you out on it.
And again, like with the criticism of Klobuchar about using experience as your thing, but then not actually having it manifest and knowing what's going on. It, like, he got like 6 months of positive coverage of speaking a bunch of languages. Like, that we're gonna be more critical of that sort of flub.
Yep.
If I did it, nobody's surprised. Yep. But I don't say that I'm great with languages. However, what you just saw there is going to look not quite so bad for Pete Buttigieg in comparison to how some other candidates are attempting to establish their credibility. Understand, this was at, I believe it was at the Culinary Union meeting in Nevada. We're right, like it's just about to happen. Here is Amy Klobuchar apparently attempting to sort of bridge that gap.
So let me tell you first about me. My name is Amy, and when I took Spanish in fourth grade, my name was Elena. They gave me the name Elena because I couldn't roll my R's very, very well. And so it was E-L-E-N-A. And I am just, first, my story is this.
Don't do that.
Like, who cares?
That
you know
what? Seems really bad.
My Spanish name in school was Javier. Who cares? I could roll my R's. So that means I'm qualified to be president. Who cares? Many people couldn't roll their R's. Some could. Mm-hmm. What difference does that make?
At the possible risk of me looking really stupid here, I get that she was like, "Hey, I'm Amy Klobuchar, but I took Spanish once when she's surrounded by a bunch of people who speak Spanish," which sort of bothers me. But then the story doesn't make any sense to me, because yes, I get that you take a class when you're growing up and they give you a different name or whatever. So your name is Amy and you can't roll your R's. Fine, a lot of people can't. So Klobuchar has an R in it, I get that. But they didn't change your last name, they changed your first name, which doesn't have any R's in
it. Yeah, I still don't
know. So I don't get the story.
Yeah, I don't know where the rolling R's came from. I don't know. I was just gonna be the idiot and I didn't get it and be like, I don't wanna bring it up because maybe everyone got it and I didn't.
Maybe don't bring up any of that. Don't. That's so weird.
Here's a novel idea. If you're looking to appeal to a certain group of people, don't act like you're in a part of their heritage. Just how about you propose some policies that would actually help their lives? Crazy.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You know what? You can even propose that in English.
No rolled R's required. Required. Okay.
Healthcare.
Okay, that was better. That's how he can pass as a native speaker amongst 13-year-olds. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. Lots more to get to. And now I'd like to welcome to the show congressional candidate in Utah's first district, Joshua Cameron. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Thank you so much. You have no idea what an honor this is.
And the same from me. Very excited to talk to you about a number of different things, including in your personal history, books that you've written. Very excited about that. But before all of that, though, I'd like you to introduce yourself to our audience. You know, what's your life experience like? What are you bringing to this run?
Sure. Thanks for the opportunity. Well, I mean, at 19, I experienced pretty much what every American goes through. Like, what the heck do I do with my life? I had an older brother that encouraged me to join the Army. Whether that was a good idea or not, I took a lot of value out of it. But then, like, as important as that was to me, as I got out, I really started understanding behind the curtain and like the military industrial complex and like the civilians that I saw in my combat support hospital that we received, you know, as I was acting in the capacity of a combat medic. I realized that these are civilians that thought it would be a good idea to live where we thought it'd be a good idea to enact an illegal war. And so this really started unraveling a thread of mine where, like, you know, if I really am going to be proud about my military service, you know, perhaps I should actually try and bring legitimate honor. And that kind of, you know, started this journey. And, you know, I've had a lot of blue collar experiences. I've worked in factories in Indiana. Yes, Mike Pence is Indiana. I've even here in Utah, I've driven over the road as a truck driver. I've worked at Halliburton, lost my job due to the oil bust. So I have a real real understanding of the stresses that the blue collar workers really have to go through, especially volatile energy sectors. And I want to use my experiences to be able to kind of bring voice to the pain in a rational and competent manner, in hopes to show that like FDR style policing really is something that I think can help the average American, especially the ward system here in Utah. Pretty much emulates that.
It's interesting. We saw a quote from you where you said you wanted to sort of harness the intersection of conservative and progressive policy values. What are some examples of that intersection?
Sure. All right. And again, thanks for that. So with Halliburton, I worked 2 weeks on, 1 week off. I had about a 3.5 hour drive from my place of employment in my actual house. So that was a bit stressful. But then also if I was expected to actually make decent amount of money, I had to work literally 100 hour weeks. I was expected to cheat on my drive, my paper logs as I was, if I was driving. And so there's a lot of just unethical behavior. And then, with me, I was what's called a logger. And so logger, we send all these giant tools, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pounds down into an actual bored out well, oil well. So we can figure out what's shale, what's limestone, what's hydrocarbon, what's water. So we can figure out what can be expressed. And if you've been working 100 hours and you're dealing with these tools that, if there's some sort of mechanical failure, they break from the wire line, you're crushed. And you're not really, you don't have the wherewithal to be able to react in a manner which you didn't work 100 hours a week. So how can I get to a system where one, we can have people work less hours and actually, turn around and provide opportunities for their families. But then two, in 2015, they canned about 1,000 people from the Vernal area, Vernal was literally the fastest growing city in the nation, much like Williston, North Dakota. And so all of the strip malls and all the peripheral businesses that popped up to really help these, help this economy, all, ate it as well and went under. And so, people know the real harm in a volatile market. And so I think that seeing places like Texas that have overwhelming, wind farming, these are things that we can express. We have wind farms here in Utah, solar farms. Elon Musk even pointed to that if we covered a small corner of Utah, we could supply the entire nation full of energy. And so there's realistic ways that we can help out working class families to not have them, break their backs over, a ridiculous amount of hours per week, but then also have it be less volatile. So then they have a place to provide opportunities for the family. And as a consequence, it cleans up our air and our water. How is that an objectionable stance? And so as I unpack these with my conservative friends and colleagues here at the University of Utah, they really see the value in there. They're propagandized against, socialism because, immediately they go to Venezuela. But as I have these personal communications, they really get drawn into my ideas, even if they're immediately kind of poisoned against the idea of democratic socialism.
So I have to ask you about a book that you wrote. Aiming Higher, How Video Gaming Made Me a Better Player at the Games of Life and Politics. I don't think a book has ever been more squarely targeted at me as a person. And so tell me a little bit about that.
Sure. So I was the spokesperson for a wonderful group called Our Voice USA, which has turned into a Hello Voter app. It's free, open source technology for anyone who's used NGPVAN. It's pretty much got the exact same things available. And so with my spokesmanship, I really went out there. Graham Elwood was nice enough to interview me a few times to give me an opportunity. I interviewed with a guy named Krish Mohan and really put myself out there trying to run for political offices as well. And then being a father and a husband, it's stressful, man. And I felt like too much butter spread across too little toast, too little butter spread across too much toast. And so, in this space where I needed to kind of recharge, there's all the shenanigans and the garbage noise of, somebody named McCarthy actually, enacting McCarthyism to blame video games for violent behavior. And so I felt, the spirit moved me, so to speak. And I grew up as a gamer. I really love them. I'm very politically aware. And I tried to move my calculus based on facts. And so the struggles and the barriers and the life lessons I learned from playing video games, the friends that I've made along the way, right? These are very valuable things to my life, and they very much feed and influence the way in which I look at the world. And I think that there's a lot of good, a lot of problem solving good. I mean, surgeons, you know, play video games. Mm-hmm. Astronauts have to play video games, you know, and they call them simulators, but still, you know, there's a huge value, you know, a positive value from playing video games. But like anything, you know, excess can lead to, you know, waste and, you know, may not be exactly what you're looking for. And so I wanted to reach out people who felt alienated from this garbage talk and kind of tip my hat and say, guys, like this really is for us. And so that's why the play on words there is gaming higher and not just aiming higher. And like the reason why there's a zombie there with like a gentleman's chapeau and a monocle is like, this is a class warfare. All throughout the book, I describe that, you know, this is a billionaire undead, a movement. Mm-hmm. And their wealth is much like the bite of an undead zombie, that it's perverse and it completely destroys, you know, the body. And in this case, the body politic.
You don't need to tell me. I'm aware of the threat of the undead. No, I wish that we had more time, Joshua, because this is all fascinating. Hopefully, we can reconnect and talk a little bit further into your run. But you're coming at this from a very interesting perspective, and we want to thank you for joining us. Where can people find out more about your candidacy?
So you can go to joshuaforchange.com. I also have a couple of op-eds that have been published in the Tribune, which is the largest paper in Utah. This latest one just 2 days ago. So you can kind of, you know, learn about me peripherally just by Google searching, or just go to my webpage and that'll connect you to my social media.
Awesome. Joshua Kamen, thank you so much for joining us.
It's an honor, sir. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We're gonna take one last break and we're gonna come back and talk a little bit about Rush Limbaugh and Pete Buttigieg after this. You've probably heard by now that Rush Limbaugh recently opined that Donald Trump would have a field day running against Pete Buttigieg because Pete Buttigieg has kissed his husband where people can see. And presumably Trump, or at least Trump supporters, would find that to be funny in some fashion. Anyway, Fox was talking about it, and take a look how the Fox host responds when Jessica Tarlov talks about how some other candidates and politicians have conducted themselves in terms of their personal life.
When you hear these criticisms from the right, and this has been consistent even going from Bill Barr saying that progressives or the secular left are responsible for the moral decay of the country, and you see a loving monogamous couple like Pete Buttigieg and Chasten, his husband, up there showing what is possible, that someone who is in a same-sex relationship could be running for president and doing this well. And then they're torn down by Rush Limbaugh, who's been married four times, I think. We have Donald Trump, three times married, cheated on all of those wives, and you hear
these. Let's not bring in personal relationships,
but we could
say exactly what it is that Rush Limbaugh says so that it's fair in the conversation here. On his radio show, he said a gay guy, 37 years old, loves kissing his husband on debate stages. Can you see Trump have fun with that?
Hey, let's not bring up personal relationships now. Back to his personal relationship. What are you talking about? That's the whole thing. Rush is saying that Trump will want to talk about his personal relationship.
It makes me wonder if someone in her ear said, hey, stop, shut it down. She's going too far. Hey, President Trump is watching. Or if she just knows because she's already been robotically trained to make sure that you know, Trump could be watching at any moment to any of our Fox programs. So make sure he's not angry about what anyone has said. Because you know what the tweet will come is, how dare they have this lib on the show to talk about this that she knows nothing about. That's what was coming and that's what they're protecting themselves.
Exactly. Yeah. That news person on Fox is like, wait, we can't let people be reminded that Trump is not anything that he presents himself to be. Which is, of course, funny. Now, Rush Limbaugh, we don't have time to show you the video, but Rush Limbaugh says that Trump called him after this comment caused controversy to say, don't apologize for anything. You want to say homophobic stuff about Pete Buttigieg, you just keep doing it, okay?
That works out. First off, if that call happened.
Medal of Freedom winner, Rush Limbaugh.
Exactly. If that call happened, it's the least surprising call you'll ever hear about. And number two, Rush Limbaugh needs no encouragement to not apologize for something he said. He's been doing it his entire life. So no need for that call from Trump.
Exactly. Anyway, it's just so absurd. Look, I don't want to talk about people's personal relationships or anything, but like of two guys, maybe throw Rudy Giuliani. What is that, 11 divorces between them? Tell us more about how people should conduct themselves in their relationships. Anyway, JR, thank you so much for joining me. Great to have you here.
For a minute, and then we talked about
it. I apologize, I ruined it. But you know what, tonight, the debate, that should be a lot of fun. We're gonna be doing live commentary as soon as the debate ends.
Yeah.
And JR is gonna be there as well. So you're definitely gonna want to see that. And you know, that's it. That's signing off. John Iarola, or as they called me in fifth grade Spanish, Juan Iarola. See you later. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Iarola. I'll see you soon.